And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy, being heard around the world. Well, we have a special guest today. Her name, Deanna Spingola. And she's been with us before, and I rather enjoyed her visit. And I know that you're going to enjoy it again today. I have her book here in front of me, and wow, I've been reading it here off and on the last few days. It's a great book, very gorgeous cover, by the way. You cannot always tell a book by the cover, but in this case, I think you can. I like the title, too, because it really explains what it's about and the importance of it for you and me, our families and loved ones, our nation, and really the entire world. It's entitled The Ruling Elite, and the subtitle is very interesting. The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. Deanna Spingola has put, well, her neck out, and she doesn't beat around the bush. She doesn't say there's a plot or a conspiracy. She says they've seized world power, the Zionist seizure of world power. I'll be asking her maybe in the next 58 minutes or so, is that an accomplished fact? Or do they still have some mop-up operations to finish, all those things of total power? But certainly they've gone a long way. In this book, the reason I find it very fascinating and important is it is packed with facts. You will not see a book, I don't think, of this nature. Really, it bests so much all of the books of history and replaces them. You could go to your library and get 200 or 300 books on history that covers this period, which really is especially about the 20th century. Woodrow Wilson, of course, all the way through Franklin Roosevelt. Understand there's a third volume in this series by Ms. Spingola. But I think this is perhaps the most important because it explains how the Zionists have seized power. And as Winston Churchill once said, you know, they have the world. He talked about the Soviet Empire at that time. But they have the world by the scrap of the neck. And we're all in big, big trouble. This book is packed with information. Let me tell you a little bit about the size of it so you'll understand that we're not talking about a paperback novel. This is not a dime store book. It's 737 pages. That's the text. And then we go on another, 20 pages. I don't know. Maybe not that much. Let's see. It comes to a cumulative 762 pages. 762 pages, an amazing book. Deanna Spingola, by the way, has her own radio program on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Let's see, she has a website too, spingola.com. That's pretty easy. S-P-I-N-G, spingola.com. And, of course, through powerofprophecy.com, you can order her first book and we now have available this second book as well. Deanna Spingola has her radio program is very interesting, and you'll want to get that. Spingola.com/radio schedule and see what she's got coming up on her interview program. Deanna, welcome to Power Prophecy.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again.
Well, it's easy for me because I want to have a guest on this program that have something important to say. You've done incredible research. How long did it take you to amass all the evidence, documentation you have here, and then put it all together in a book, Deanna?
Well, I started in January of 2009, and I was just going to write one book, and it turned out that this one book was 1,200 pages, and so I decided to break it up into three books, with each one being 400 pages. And so the first book came out, and it was something like 700 and something pages.
Yes.
And then this one It grew also, and, you know, it's over 700 pages also, and I anticipate that the third book will also grow.
Well, I don't doubt that it does, but the interesting thing, I'm looking at the table of contents, Deanna, and wow, everything you'd want to know about the Khazars, British Zionism, you know, what happened in Turkey, the horrible Armenian genocide, our Armenian friends, Christians, will want to get the book just for that section of the book. Then there's the social engineering, what happened with the communist period of the Jews, the millions of people killed there and so forth, multiculturalism, imperialism and warfare, how they've used the United States, all of the revolutionary activities of Jewish Zionists. Of course, and Israel, how Israel was founded, you might say the beginnings of it with the Balfour
Declaration.
Mm-hmm. Declaration, thank you. And so much more. Even the communist infiltration in China and the especially the, we're now in a terrible economic down spiral right now, but you also cover the 1929 period on, and how Roosevelt took office and how you explained very careful about Bernard Baruch and the other Jews around him. And basically it was a Zionist, administration. Now, why did you write a book about the Zionist seizure of power? There are almost no books out there on the subject. And suddenly you have the master book. You have the, a definitive history account here. How did this interest you? What got into you, I guess you could say?
Well, it's kind of a continuation of my first book, and which is a lot about the socialist revolution in our country, which many people refer to as the Civil War. And basically, it was our version of the Bolshevik Revolution here in this country, which changed drastically our structure of government. And then from there, in the second book, I had to go back a little bit to early 1806 specifically, in order to show exactly where Zionism came from. Because what the Jews did, they couldn't just go in and, you know, take over the Holy Land. There had to be some noble purpose. And so Zionism was born. And it was actually born in Britain. And, of course, by then, the Rothschilds were very much in control of the government there. And so they decided that they would start preaching about Christianity to the Jews there in Britain. And it was just to a particular group of Jews, and they started the Christian Zionism started in Britain, and then it came over to this country. But cloaked in religion, they were able to do things that they weren't able to do just as a group of Jews. They had to get the Christians involved in it in order to make it work.
Now, that's very interesting. You know, I did a video some time back called Thunder Over Zion, and I quoted a well-known rabbi who said that eventually Christianity, which in his mind, his writings, proceeded out of Judaism, will be swallowed back up into Judaism. So they've had their eye really on the Christian church, the hatefulness of the Jews toward Jesus Christ and the Christian church and community. But yet what they've done is masterful, isn't it? In organizing Christians to support really their own death, their own demise.
Yes, indeed. And that is exactly what they did. And it's very deliberate. They knew that they couldn't do it themselves, and they also had to get certain political leaders to back them, which they did. And the first one to back them and to promise that he would restore them to Palestine was actually Napoleon Bonaparte, who was a Freemason, and he was encamped in Acre in 1799, and he promised that he would give them Palestine.
Now, why would he do that? He was, of course, the French had their revolution and overthrown King Louis, mm-hmm. and then he rose out of all the chaos and turmoil there to make himself emperor. Evidently, one of the Jews' real tricks or ruses is to destabilize a country, isn't it? Like they destabilize France. And then, you know, once you have a country in chaos, turmoil, people not knowing what to do, they're confused, they're angry, some of them, others are frightened. evidently you can put your own puppets in power then and really roll, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, the one thing that the Jews have that the rest of us don't have is unity. And they are very, very well unified, deliberately so. They were ghettoized. The rabbis had them had them under their thumb. You know, we often think that, oh, those poor Jews, the people around them made them live in ghettos and separate from the rest of the community. No, it wasn't like that at all. The Jews decided to live that way, and their rabbis encouraged them to live that way so that they could control their lives. And just about every aspect of a Jewish life is under the control of the rabbi. And so it was very easy for them to adopt and accept willingly communism and anything that it entailed. But one of the first meetings that they had is called an Assembly of Notables, and it was a group of people who consulted with the French emperor on state matters, and they issued a proclamation to Europe's Jewish communities inviting them to send delegates to the Sanhedrin, which was scheduled for October 20th of 1806 in Paris. And now the meeting didn't actually take place until February 9th, 1807, when 100 rabbis and 25 lay people from various parts of Europe met to authorize, in behalf of world Jewry, any compact made with Napoleon or presumably any other government leader who would support them. And so we often think, or people, we hear people say, well, it's not all Jews that are bad. It's not all the, you know, I know the guy down the street and he's a really nice guy. But when it comes push to shove and when there's an outside threat or when they want to accomplish something, they unify. And that is what they did when they held this first Sanhedrin meeting. And this was just after or just before they won emancipation in Germany. And so this was, you know, after the Enlightenment, and every, you know, people were saying, oh, writing books and saying, oh, we've got to let them be emancipated, let them be equal. But the Jews never wanted to be equal. They don't want equality. They want supremacy. And that is what their objectives are. And so you have these 100 rabbis and 25 other people who basically composed the Sanhedrin. Now, we read in the New Testament about the Sanhedrin, and it basically is the ruling body for the world Jewry. And when people, Jews, who oppose any kind of unification of their objectives, or, you know, speak out or something, people, other Jews, call them self-hating Jews, or they criticize them, but they always ostracize them. And so Jews always go along with their leaders, always, always, and they're always very unified, and they always have objectives. And even though they had a diaspora where, you know, Jews went all over the world, they always had the unification. They always had communication. They developed the first communication apparatus so that they could stay in touch. And the Jews actually, when they went into other countries, always assumed leadership positions in those countries. And most of it was because of their economic advancement. They always had sufficient money because they were always the tradespeople. So they were, you know, they had the money. And they also incorporated usury. And so they made money off of the labors of others. And with that money, they sought power and were able to lend money to various countries. And as soon as, you know, whoever writes a check calls the shots.
Oh, sure. You know, a lot of people have asked me, why do Jews own America's high-tech industries? You know, everywhere you look, Zuckerberg with Facebook, Michael Dell with Dell Computers, Jeff Bezos with Amazon.com. You find a very rich Jew who's in control. You know, it doesn't matter, Microsoft, Bill Gates, of course, and on and on. But, you know, it takes money to found a business. Entrepreneurs are very limited in their ability to grow without capital, without loans, and so forth. So evidently the Jews help each other, and they suppress the Gentiles. I remember reading a long time ago the story of Sears and Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, America would have periodic depressions and panics, of a financial nature. And both Sears and Roebuck, I forget which one sold out to the other one, but whichever one was left, I think it was Sears. He had a horrible problem financially during one of these, economic downturns in America. And he was basically forced to sell Sears and Roebuck to a Jew. So from about 1920s on, the Jews own Sears and Roebuck. And this is what they do. And sometimes they cause those economic downturns and depressions and recessions with their banks. And then they buy off all the property and land and so forth at a very, cheap rate, almost for peanuts. And this makes them even richer. A guy named Yockey once wrote a book called Imperium, where he basically said the Jews constitute parasites within each land. They're like cancer in a way. It sticks together and it grows and it metastasizes in the body. But think of America. You mentioned in your book how few Jews really we have, and yet what awesome and horrible power they wield. Isn't that true that we have so few Jews that numerically they should be no different than the Greeks or the Turks in America or the Italians and so forth?
Well, they refuse to assimilate. And the other thing that they do, and they do it in every single country, and they did it in Germany, they did it in this country. You were talking about how they decide that there's going to be an economic catastrophe. And during those catastrophes, they go in and they buy up all the property. They did it in 1837. They did it in 1857. They did it, every time we have, 1929. They did the same thing. They did the same thing in Germany. They come in and they buy up property. And they also, because of their psychopathical composition, they also will do anything that it takes to get ahead. They will walk over the back of other people, whereas the Christian or the, regular common person treats people with respect. They also obey the law, but the Jew doesn't do that. They circumvent the law. They do anything that it takes, lie, cheat, steal, whatever it takes to get ahead, and they have no conscience, and that is what they do. So that 2%, I was talking to someone earlier today, and they said, How can all of these Jews be on TV and be dominating the news and be the host on this program, the host on that program, when it's only 2% of the population, basically, just about 2%. And it's because they are the leaders in communication, and you mentioned all of these websites. They do own these websites. They are in charge of technology. For instance, when Tesla died, died a pauper. And yet he had all of these patents, and the U.S. government seized those patents. Well, who is in control of the U.S. government? The Jews. So obviously they are going to get the patents. They are going to take advantage of all the stuff that the U.S. government does for them. Because remember that the U.S. government is basically the U.S. military. And whatever whatever the Jews want, they will use military force to get it. For instance, when the U.S. invaded Germany in World War II, they confiscated all of the technology, all of the patents, everything, brought it back here, and then distributed them. And who got those patents? Undoubtedly, the Jews did. And you mentioned Bill Gates. Well, Bill Gates, his father, he didn't start in his garage. We always hear this story. Oh, Bill Gates was just a student, and he just started this thing in his garage. Well, his father was a big-time lawyer, who was associated with one of the biggest lobby firms in Washington, D.C. So, all of these people, and his mother worked for IBM. And so, they have their fingers in every important aspect of the community, whether we're talking of the Jewish colony in Hollywood, wherein they basically shape our perceptions through entertainment. And they've been doing it ever since the beginning.
They really do. And, Hollywood, I remember reading the book, An Empire of Their Own, where the author, who's Jewish, talked about how the Jews basically took over Hollywood. And it was not only Jews, but a small number of Jews from Soviet Russia that had come over. So they really stick together, help each other. And, of course, doesn't even their Talmud tell them that it's a holy thing, basically? They're doing a bar mitzvah, you might say, to shaft Gentiles.
Oh, absolutely. That's part of their religion.
It's part of their religion that they're supposed to cheat us, lie, steal. And if they do so, they're doing something good. It's an act, a work. And, of course, theirs is a works-based religion. So they're doing something. They believe that their God, their deity, by whatever name they call him, there are many names, will reward them for their cunning and their mental agility in stealing things from the Gentiles. This is what they're supposed to do. And, of course, it gets down to finally where it says the best of the Gentiles, kill. That's in their Talmud. So in America, then, we have 2%, you say, that are Jewish. And yet, the politicians bow down to these 2%. I mean, we would be aghast to discover that either the Jewish ADL, I suppose, Deanna, or the AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the most powerful lobby group in the world, if all of these politicians, Democrat and Republican, didn't parade themselves, prostrate themselves before the Jews at their annual conventions of these Jewish organizations, that would be a shock itself, wouldn't it?
Yes. But when you consider what they do to the ones that don't bow down, it kind of keeps the rest of them in line. Now, I demonstrate in my book that the Jews were the first to use these terrorist activities, and they started killing people, assassinating people in Russia early on. And this is how they control people, is that they use terrorism. And it's just amazing they're still doing it with 9/11. And I really believe that if you look at, well, the USS Liberty, mm-hmm. There are many indications that they are behind a lot of this, and, of course, behind the JFK assassination, the assassination of his brother. And in all of these events, you have to look at who benefited. And it's always them.
It's always them. That's true. Well,
and then they also, I'm sorry, they also use, they get some dirt on some politician that they threaten to expose if that politician doesn't do what he's supposed to do. And that's what they do.
You know, the Protocols of Zion are really a masterful book of their own. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy as to whether some Jewish high council, you know, the Zionist Congress or whatever, that these came out of that, the Protocols of Zion. But they're a tremendous description of what, you know, what the Jews are doing. As Henry Ford said, you know, all he can say, he said, all I can say is that they exactly fit the events of the world and what is going on. I love your book, the new one, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power, Deanna, because you document all these things. It's interesting to me that professors of history at the universities must themselves realize that the various journals, even the universities, that they really cannot keep their positions. They certainly would never get tenure unless they bowed down to the Jews. And that's why we don't get any books on world history that are accurate about the Jews, do we?
No. And then you have organizations like the American Historical Association, which basically influence most historians or history teachers. And, of course, they were initially funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And they decided that they were going to dominate and regulate domestic education, and the Carnegie Foundation dominated international education. And so that is why your typical history books will not include any of this stuff. And, of course, the students in school are indoctrinated to believe what the American Historical Association sets down as history. And so it's very, very important that we have books that portray accurate history so that we know what has happened, so that we can deal with what is happening to us now.
You know, when I turn on TV, cable interview and news programs, I see something like C-SPAN. And they'll have an author there, you know, historian so-and-so, and he's talking about World War I or Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, some of the many subjects that you're talking about in your book. I have no interest in listening to those programs because they're all totally propaganda. There's nothing there. Whereas your book, there's new stuff because you've gone out and found out what is real history. But C-SPAN or a program like Charlie Rose program. Of course, Charlie Rose himself is a member of the CFR and is Jewish. It's interesting how they put a ban, a censor. You know, when people talk about free speech in America, and I hear, O'Reilly and Sean Hannity talk about Chick-fil-A should have the right to speak their piece. You know, we should have freedom of speech. But they themselves at Fox News, at CNN, ABC, they will not have the Deanna Spingolas, to talk about the truth. You are absolutely banned. So am I, of course. Anyone who tells the truth. I think it is amazing that Chick-fil-A somehow got through this time. Believe me, the Jews and the homosexuals will not let many of those kind of things happen again. They'll prepare next time to destroy a man like Dan Cathy. But, I think your book is going to do real well because there are a growing number of people, Deanna, who love the truth and who are sick and tired of being lied to. And thank God for them, and the internet helps them, and we'll get this book out to more and more people, and my audience will love this book. But isn't it a shame that all the media propaganda will not allow us to come on and even debate this with people?
Exactly. Well, you know, the Jews are also in charge of publishing, many of the publishing companies, even these so-called alternative publishing companies. That is why I have had to self-publish.
Oh, sure. And as good as your book is. Well, you know, I before I went into a Christian ministry, I guess for I don't know how many years, I wrote, I had a company called Tech Trends, Technology Trends. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a book for major New York publishers, many books for major New York publishers. I cannot remember ever having an editor who was not Jewish. Think about that. My books have been published by the biggest publishers in America. That's before I began writing the kind of books I do now.
Right. But
when I did books on computers and high technology, you know, and these books sold extremely well. And I wrote books, John Wiley Press, Prentice Hall, McGraw-Hill, Simon & Schuster, all the biggest publishers published my books. Mm-hmm. But I cannot remember ever having an editor or editor-in-chief who was not Jewish. It just wasn't there.
Interesting.
It really is. And by the way, I remember getting my first Simon & Schuster catalog when one of my books, you know, first came out. I was very proud of it. And they sent me their annual, wasn't annual catalog, but it was one of their biggest. And it had like 400 books in there that they had published that season.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, just out of interest, I counted the number of books that were not done by Jewish authors. There was only about 10 that I could actually say this is a Gentile name. And then it hit me. They steal books from all over America and give them to Jewish authors to write. I remember Mickey Spillane, his first novel was stolen like that. That's what they do. They steal books from Gentiles all over the world, and they publish them by big names. And that's why the best-selling authors are Jews.
And, of course, then you also have the New York Times, who has their New York Times bestseller list, and they tout all these books that they want people to buy, and they really don't even have to sell a certain quantity of books in order to get on that list. You have to have the right book. And they'll promote it. I mean,
it
sells 10 copies, and it would be on the New York Times bestseller list if that is where they wished it to be. And you mentioned Simon & Schuster, which is, Jewish. And Bernard Baruch is the one that first funded them.
Oh.
Them in business.
That's interesting. Well, we're going to talk about Bernard Baruch and a lot more when we come back, folks. You're listening to Tex Mars, Power of Prophecy. My special guest is a very special lady. Her name is Deanna Spingola. Her book, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. Stay around. We'll talk about a lot more things when we return. Texmore's back again. I want to tell you how to get this book. Outstanding book, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power by Deanna Spingola. And by the way, that's spelled S-P-I-N-G-O-L-A. The book, of course, is over 700 pages, and it's only $35. It's about the size of about, three or four regular books, you might say. But it has 10 times the information as the three or four books. And I think you're going to love this. You'll learn how the Federal Reserve came about. World War One, the IRS, how it was formed, how the Zionists had a hand in all of these things. It covers Woodrow Wilson, President Wilson, who certainly, as Deanna will probably explain in just a moment, I'm going to ask her that question, no doubt was a servant, maybe even a prisoner of the Zionist. We'll talk about Sir Winston Churchill, Vladimir Lenin, and the communists, how they took power in the Soviet Union. And then this book also covers the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Very interesting there. But it basically tells you how the Zionists during the 20th century were able to seize world power. And you'll understand how they're able to wield that power today in America. And things are getting more grim, more dark, more controlling, more big brotherish, even today as we talk on this program. We have very little time left, I'm convinced of that. So we need all the evidences, all the truth that we can amass. And that's why I offer this book, all right? You should have this book in every bookstore in America, but it won't be there. I can just guarantee it. If it is, well, thank God. Then God somehow has opened doors for Deanna Spingola, and I thank him for that. But right now, there are very few places you can get this book. The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. When you call us toll-free to order the book, just ask for the Zionist book, okay? The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Book by Deanna Spingola. And we're going to have sufficient quantities here to take care of you, okay? We're going to keep them on hand for a long, long time because I think this book is one of the most valuable that I have ever read. Now, the book is $35. When you order it, please remember to include $5 for shipping and handling. That would be a total of $40 for this book. And as I said, it's not one you can put in your back pocket. It's pretty heavy. It's pretty big, but it's important. And I think you will enjoy it. You'll find things in here that, well, they've been put together in such a way that no other book is like it. Now, to get your book, The Ruling Elite, the second book, The Zionist Book by Deanna Spingola, just phone us toll-free, 1-800-234-9673, 1-800-234-9673. You can also write to us, of course, Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson, P-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And, of course, you can go on our website. This book is right on our homepage. Right now, after the program, maybe you're listening to it on thepowerofprophecy.com. You're listening to the program. A lot of people do. I'd say about 50% listen to it by radio and 50% by internet. Wouldn't you say, Jerry? Sort of a mixture there. But in any case, if you're listening by internet, great. Just scroll somewhere there on the homepage, and you'll see this book offered. Click onto it, and you use your charge card and order it from powerofprophecy.com. The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. $35 plus $5 shipping and handling. All right? By Deanna Spingola. Again, I want to mention Deanna's radio program is on the Republic Broadcasting Network. That radio schedule, of course, is at republicbroadcasting.org. You can also go to spingola.com/radio schedule and get that the time and everything. But let me just tell you right now, if you got a pencil, you can write it down Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's Central Time there on the Republic Broadcasting Network. That would be my good friend there, John Stanton Miller. All right, let's return to the program, Power of Prophecy. I'm Tex Morris, and my guest is Deanna Spingola. Welcome back, Deanna.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, one of the most interesting presidents was Woodrow Wilson. I once saw a movie that I'm sure was published by Jewish producers. And boy, they made him look like a lion. He was a hero. I mean, here was a guy that loved peace, that wanted the world to be a democracy. Now, you're laughing. See, I like that. Why are you laughing? What's the truth about Woodrow Wilson?
Well, first of all, he was the son of one of the founders of the Southern Presbyterian Church. And it's quite interesting that Sigmund Freud and William C. Bullitt created a book. They wrote a book. It's called Thomas Woodrow Wilson, A Psychological Study. And in that book, they say that he was... that people laughed at him because he was a mama's boy and he was a sensitive bundle of nerves. And he went on to graduate from Princeton in 1879. He attended law school at the University of Virginia and then Johns Hopkins University for graduate work in political science and history. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on congressional government. He felt that the Constitution was totally outmoded, just, you know, they should scrap it. And he was good buddies with James Ramsay MacDonald, who was a Fabian socialist and later the Prime Minister of England. And they met together probably in 1897, and they both agreed that the U.S. Constitution was obsolete and needed replacing. And Wilson, in his first book, it was called Congressional Government, A Study in American Politics, also criticized what he called the outdated principles. And he promoted a centralized government with increased control over citizens' lives. Now, remember that after the Civil War, the government became very centralized. They made, you know, they added the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, several other amendments by the time that, Wilson became president, including for the income tax and also for instituting the Federal Reserve. But anyway, when you look at the people that he went to school with, he went to school with Cleveland H. Dodge, whose father, William E. Dodge, Jr., was a very wealthy industrialist, and he helped organize the YMCA in America. Now, you know that YMCA is kind of has a Freemasonic foundation, which I cover in the book. But anyway, Dodge decided that Wilson would be a really good presidential material. He'd be a good president, and he also told his Wall Street friends that this guy would serve their interest. And so in 1890, to enhance his credibility for this high public office, Dodge and his mother, who were both on the Princeton board, donated heavily to Princeton with the understanding that Wilson would be able to get a professorship there. Thereafter, Dodge and the other trustees selected Wilson as president in order to promote him, to make him look good. So basically, his friends bought Wilson's way into Princeton, first as a professor. Then they installed him as president, which really enhanced his, you know, it was a very prestigious institution. And so this put him in a position where he would look really good. And Dodge and some of these other cronies of his also subsidized Wilson with $5,000 a year the whole time he was at Princeton. So he was completely indebted to the industrialists before he ever thought to run for public office. They already owned him.
Now, he evidently had some scandal going on at the time, some things he had done they sort of were able to also hold that over him, right?
Right. He decided when he was at Princeton that he was very tired. He needed to, because of all the tension and the stress that he was under, he decided that he needed to have a little vacation.
Okay, grading those papers and everything, that's so tough, you know. I'm sure burnout occurs, right?
Right. And his wife stayed home to take care of a sick daughter. So in January of 1908, according to his doctor's recommendation, and who knows who his doctor was, you know, I did not find that information, but I just have a funny feeling that the guy was probably a Jewish doctor. And so Wilson went down for a vacation to Bermuda, and he arrived there on January 20th. And Mary Peck from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, was a vivacious, prim, sophisticated, musically talented, unhappily married 45-year-old woman. And she just happened to rent one of Bermuda's historic houses every single year. Now, I think this is very, I think this whole thing was a setup. I really do. So Wilson, now remember, he's a preacher's son, he goes down there, and she is staying at a house across the harbor from the Hamilton Hotel where he was staying. But anyway, they got very chummy. She found him rather stilted and puritanical, but he was absolutely crazy about her, just absolutely crazy about her. And she was so different than Wilson's wife. And she was all very enthusiastic about his political aspirations. And by February, he was referring to her as my precious one, my beloved Mary. So after the trip, Wilson continued to write her. Now remember, she was married. But after the trip, he continued to write her. And in December of 1911, she filed for divorce from her wealthy industrialist husband, Thomas D. Peck, and assumed her previous maiden name, her former name, because she's married before. And so, anyway, this was kind of a little glitch in this otherwise, you know, he had a perfect record. I mean, he was a preacher's son, and he'd never done anything wrong. You know, not any of the kinds of things that presidents and the candidates do now. But for that period of time, it was something really big. I mean, he wrote all of these letters.
So you think the Wall Street crowd sort of arranged this for him, you think, huh?
Oh, yes. They used these letters. Bernard Baruch bought these letters for $65,000. And they blackmailed Wilson after he got into the White House. They blackmailed him, and they said, we are going to divulge the contents of these letters unless, and he ran for president in 1912. And actually, there was a third-party candidate, and he was kind of a shoo-in. It was all arranged that he would go in. And so they used these letters, and they said, okay, you will appoint Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court,
a Jewish,
or we
judge.
Will divulge the contents of these letters. And basically, they also ran the rest of his administration. They told him who to appoint for Secretary of the Treasury. They also had certain people that they put into his area of influence who would basically handle him. He was promoted as a man of peace, but he really wasn't. I mean, he would do whatever that he was told to do, and ready and willing to do it.
So we have the
Colonel Edward Mandel House was his handler.
You
and
know,
this guy was, he had a working copy of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion.
I remember reading about that in his personal papers after his death.
Yes.
They found a copy of the Protocols of Zion. I wonder if it was a working copy for him. You know, I come from Beaumont, Texas, and where they found the, one of the, really it was the second, but it was the largest store of oil. And at that time, it was like incredible. No one even knew that there could be so much oil underground any particular place. But there at the Spindletop oil field, they found this incredible store of oil. And the town and city grew just tremendously fast. And, of course, Rockefeller got involved very fast, too, because, his Standard Oil and certainly wanted to tie up all the oil because it was the Wildcatters, the Independents, that had found it. But interestingly enough, it was E. Mandel House that showed up in Beaumont, Texas, with money in hand, buying up the oil lands left and right, Deanna. And this is a little sideline of history, but I had a gentleman that came to see me, and we became quite good friends. And he evidently had records, from his family and such, of both the Freemasonry and, believe it or not, the Order of the Illuminati. There was an Order of the Illuminati in the United States, and he had the original certificate from the Order of the Illuminati, the Beaumont chapter of it, and the initiation and everything of E. Mandel House in the Order of the Illuminati, not to mention the Freemasonry. So I have somewhere in my files here a copy of the certificate of E. Mandel House being made a member of the Order of the Illuminati. I think that was interesting because until that time, I had not realized, you know, you think it ended back in the 1770s.
Oh, no.
With Adam Weishaupt, but it continued on evidently. But now E. Mandel House, who became, you say, the handler inside the White House for President Wilson. Have you found that most presidents of the United States, especially over the last 100 years or so, have actually had a handler, Jewish handler, behind the scenes?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely.
So now you talk about Bernard Baruch, the New York financier, another Jew, and you say that basically he ran the White House during the FDR administration.
Yes, but he was also very influential in the Wilson administration.
Oh, he was?
Yes.
Okay.
He became head of the board when we went to war. He made about millions upon millions of dollars during World War One, you know, because Wilson took us into war. He ran on a peace campaign, peace platform, but all the time, the Jews were priming him to take us into war. And that was the whole purpose for the false flag, the Lusitania, which Churchill set up. And, it was all staged so that these Jews who were close to Wilson made all kinds of money. We're talking major money.
And Wilson got us into World War One. That caused a great geographical alignment of nations and such, which assisted the Jews. But more than that, how about the IRS and the Federal Reserve Act? Tell us about that. I know you talk about it in your book.
Right. And other people in the so-called truth movement have talked about it. And I have a kind of a different spin on things. We have to remember that Congress created the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Congress created it. They benefit from it to this day. They are very complicit in it. And so if they actually wanted to get rid of it, they could. And we keep hearing, oh, it's the international bankers, it's these guys. And certainly the international bankers benefit. But when you get right down to it, it was Congress that did this to us. And it is Congress that continues to allow whatever foreign powers are handling things, are controlling things in this country, it is through Congress that they are doing that. Congress is totally compliant with their wishes, and they were totally compliant in creating what is called the banking trust and the Aldrich plan, which was basically corporate currency, and the Federal Reserve. And I have three chapters on it in my book, and I give all the details. And we hear that, oh, it was just a few members of Congress, and they did it when everybody left for Christmas vacation. That is just not true.
Mm.
It was not true. I have all the figures about who was there, and it was passed, and Congress passed it. It wasn't just a few, you know, rogue members. It was Congress. It was the House. The House passed it first, and then the Senate passed it.
So the Jewish lobby and rich Wall Street Jews have owned Congress then, the Senate and the House, all these years.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, you know, that makes sense. I read recently that very quietly, the House of Representatives passed Obama's request for the first $104 billion to be spent in 2013 for Obamacare. And I thought that was interesting. You know, all those brave guys, Speaker John Boehner and...
they're just a bunch of...
Yeah, the House Minority, the Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, who is Jewish... But they said they're going to fight Obamacare all the way. And very quietly, just 2 weeks ago, they've got the power of the purse. They could kill Obamacare just by not approving the money.
Of course.
I mean, you know, it's dead. You got to have money. But they actually approved the 2012 and 2013 budget for Obamacare. Isn't that amazing to you?
Right. And, you know, one of the things in Obamacare is the RFID chip.
Oh, yes.
And that we're supposed to all get those in 2013. Now, what is very interesting about these recent shootings, the one in Aurora, the one, and then the one in Oak Hill up in Wisconsin. And then apparently some woman walked into a hospital today and took somebody else's baby. And I'm thinking, this all has to do with Obamacare. You know, they always use every crisis to further their own agenda. Even if they didn't create the crisis, they will exploit it, manipulate it so that they can promote their own agenda. This is going to be used to sell Americans the idea that we need to be chipped, because if we were chipped, that woman could not have walked into the hospital and stole another woman's baby. You know, the people couldn't have gone into the theater, or people couldn't have gone into that church without a, you know, RFID chip. And I believe that, you know, they use all of these crises, and they always have, in order to further their own agenda and take more power, take more control over every aspect of our lives.
Hmm. Do you think we, the American people, I guess you call us we, the American people, will ever rise up and revolt against this? It is a tough thing, because such a propaganda machine, and so many, it hits us at so many levels. You know, publishing, television, internet, the presidency, the Congress. I wonder, I do believe this. Never in my lifetime have I seen books such as The Ruling Elite by Deanna Spingola. Or my newest book, Conspiracy of the Six-Pointed Star.
Which is fabulous. I love that book.
Well, thank you so very much. But for the first time, these publications are coming out, and that never has happened before. They've had everything going their way.
Exactly. The internet, even though they created it in order to keep track of us, it is allowing us to keep track of them and to spread the word about them.
Mm. So perhaps we can turn these, you know, I remember the North Vietnamese were able to thwart American technology during the Vietnam War era by very simple means. And maybe we can do that too. But boy, they have such resources against us.
Right. But if we can educate the public and really inform them about what's going on, then there's an opportunity to, as you say, thwart the plan. But, oh my goodness, they're so pervasive. And even I had a guest on a few weeks ago talking about the kosher tax.
Mm.
And you were talking earlier about how they come into businesses and really financially strap other businesses in order for them to take them over. And when they go in, when the rabbis go in, the consultants go in, and they want to have a company have the certification, the kosher certification, and most people don't know what the certification is. It's on just about 90% of all the products that we all eat and consume every day. And what these businesses have to do is that they have to conform to certain kosher, you know, policies in order to have certification. And we all pay for this certification. We pay extra money for the food, but it's these businesses that have to revamp, they have to put in a double sink, they have to put in certain machinery, they have to keep a person on staff, a consultant on staff, from year to year, and oftentimes, these businesses just simply can't afford to do it, and so they get taken over. And this is something, it's a scheme. It's a big scam.
And they have to pay the rabbis, don't they?
Yes, they have to pay the rabbis to do whatever the rabbis do.
So you can't open up a Del Monte food company or Procter & Gamble or one of the others. Nabisco or whatever, every one of your products has to have this little bitty, almost hidden little mark showing that it's been kosher approved, and you have to pay off the rabbis to get it kosher approved. It is a real scam and a bribery operation, isn't it?
Yes, it really is.
It shows the amazing power of these people. But the worst thing of all, I think, beyond that, is the use of, as you document in your book, Deanna, their use of the United States government as an imperialistic power to go out and fight wars, to murder millions of people, to create a greater Israel, world, kingdom.
Right. And they've been doing this basically, well, the first time they used the U.S. military was during the so-called Civil War in order to get the South to do exactly what they wanted them to do, which was to give up their local rights, to give up states' rights. And then the next time that they used it was, of course, against the Plains Indians to vacate the land, particularly the land that had the gold and the minerals and all the resources on it. Then the next time that they used it was in Cuba when they went into Cuba, and that was also a false flag operation because there was an explosion on the USS Maine. And they blamed Spain for this, when actually it was an internal explosion, and probably one that was set up, as I have indicated in my book. And so then, because they went into Cuba, and Cuba was under the jurisdiction of Spain at the time, then they went over to the Philippines, and then of course we know what they did in Hawaii. Because of the sugar trust, because the people wanted to avoid the tariffs of the sugar, so they basically went in and annexed Hawaii. And we never hear any of this stuff in schools, ever, ever, ever.
No, we sure we don't have the real history of the wars by any means. Are we going to be invading Iran? What do you think?
Sure.
Yeah, we would almost have to be for them to create a greater Israel. It's interesting to me, though, that one of the things is revenge, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
You know, you go all the way back to the Persians, who are the Iranians, and even though that was, 2,000 years ago, more than that, they still want revenge, don't they?
Yes, they do. That's something, I mean, even in the Book of Esther, we see that same policy is used now.
Wow.
They used it against Germany.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because Germany would not go along with their Zionistic objectives. And also because of Germany's entrepreneurship and their technology, the people behind the British, who were controlling the British government, didn't want the competition. Mm. So there were two reasons. One was for revenge, because Germany would not go along with them taking over Palestine, and that's how they took care of them. Mm. And it's amazing. You know, we think, how could people be like this? How could they be so full of hate? But remember that these are psychopathic people, and they think that the rest of us are just a bunch of cattle that they can run over and do whatever they want, because we don't have souls. Apparently we are no more than just animals, and they consider that animals don't have souls. And that's why they engage in the horrible, horrible slaughter, the kosher slaughter, which is, so cruel.
Just cruel. We should really not buy any kosher products. Well, Deanna, I'll tell you, talking about a soul, you have a beautiful soul because you have a great hunger and thirst for truth. And I want to thank you for being our guest today on Power of Prophecy and being the author of this incredible, well-documented book, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power, that we offer here on Power of Prophecy in our ministry. Thank you again, Deanna, for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
All right, that was Deanna Spangola. I'm Tex Morris. And my very fervent prayer, my dear friends, is that you will tune in each week during this same time and discover the power of prophecy.